Panthers and the Young Lords, as you just mentioned. But in fact, what happens is that this strategy backfires, and prisons, in fact, become schools of revolutionary political education. And these groups, in fact, proliferate in the prisons. And that politicization interacts with the intense repression that these groups were facing, which gives rise to these different forms of rebellion that emerge all throughout the prisons. Attica happened to be one of the most brutal prisons in New York State, and in fact, in the country, where many of the most political and most intellectual, and most charismatic people were transferred and repressed, and it turned into a tinderbox.
Professor Burton, that's where the wildcat prison guard strike is. Jose Saldana, we just have 20 seconds.
They have engaged in illegal activity, and they will continue to escalate that illegality. We are building a movement to dismantle this racial brutality. But in the meantime, we have to get people out of that brutal system. We have legislation, elder parole, fair and timely, second look at. These legislation will help relieve people out of these systems of brutal oppression and unite them back to their families.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Jose Saldana, director of RAP, and Arsanmi Burton, author of Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. He's also professor of anthropology at American University. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KBOO, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KBOO seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KBOO stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at KBOO.FM.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon health officials say this flu season is among the toughest in the past 10 years.
Estacada City Council votes to disband their Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee.
And groups in Oregon that work on the housing shortage want their funding protected by lawmakers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 26th, 2025. I'm Nate Kapp.
And I'm Danny Shy. This may be Oregon's worst flu season in the past decade. It's a nationwide trend, too. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, are calling the 2024-2025 flu season heavy severity for all age groups. That's the first time that classification has been made since 2017. It means more people than usual are going to the doctor, being hospitalized, and dying from the flu this year. In a typical flu season, the virus peaks around late December. That happened this year, too, with over 30% of Oregonians who were tested for the flu coming back with a positive. Things typically taper off at the end of January, but something strange had happened this year. Positive flu cases climbed in February. Dr. Paul Sislak with the Oregon Health Authority told OPB that it's important people get their flu vaccine. He said, quote, "This is not a quiet year for flu. I think it's going to be one of our worst. I would definitely get vaccinated if you haven't already," end quote. The flu vaccination has a reputation for not working well, which may contribute to the waning numbers of Oregonians who are taking it. But it is 40 to 50% effective at keeping people from having to go to the doctor with the flu. A 2019 CDC study found that the flu vaccine reduced the worst flu outcomes for kids by around 75%. Even when the vaccine was for a strain of the virus that wasn't a perfect match. Health officials also recommend proactively test for the flu. This year, there is an over-the-counter test available for pharmacies that test for influenza A, B, and COVID. Knowing what type of virus you have can help with treatment. Antiviral treatments for the flu work best if they are started a day or two after symptoms start.
The Estacada City Council voted to dissolve its Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee on Monday. The vote was 5-2. The committee was created in October of 2020 to advise the City Council on how to better reach and serve underrepresented residents. Estacada is the second Oregon government to dissolve their DEI committee. Deschutes County ended their DEI committee at the beginning of February. This comes as President Trump has ordered a rollback on federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, inspiring other companies and agencies to follow. Oregon localities are not required by his orders to end their DEI committees. Nearly 100 Estacada locals signed a petition asking the council not to dissolve the committee. The city councilors who voted to end the committee said the committee was too political and it could get in the way of them getting federal funding. Councilor Heidi Prokop voted to keep the committee. She was skeptical of the debate over the DEI committee's work. Prokop said, quote, "Nobody's bringing up examples of the actual harm the committee is doing to our residents. I'm hearing bizarre, off-the-wall reasoning to get rid of it. Everyone is bringing up national issues that don't have anything to do with the committee's work and its actual purpose," end quote.
Groups working to help address the shortage of affordable housing in Oregon are asking that their state funding be renewed this year. The Homeownership Development Incubator Program, or HDIP, provides homes for low and moderate income families that are sold based on the area's median income. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Groups working to address Oregon's shortage of affordable housing are backing a bill to fund the state's Home Ownership Development Incubator Program. Originally launched by the state in 2022, the program known as HDIP funds developers who build housing for low to moderate income families. Katie Curry is with McMinnville Area Habitat for Humanity, which was one of eight projects awarded the first round of HDIP funds. She says the money helped them ramp up housing construction.
We're just able to build at a much quicker pace and offer these homeownership opportunities for people in our community. So it's been a game changer.
HDIP funds are available both for nonprofit and for-profit organizations and also for tribes and private developers. The homes must be priced based on the area's median income. The state is seeking $50 million to fund HDIP again, and the bill is now in committee in Salem. Research shows rapid population growth, housing underproduction, and pandemic-driven costs have all made Oregon's housing shortage worse, with home prices far outpacing wages. Curry says the average household income in McMinnville is a little over $65,000, but would need to be more than double that in order to afford a typical home in the area. State and local governments recognize it's a serious issue in Oregon, Curry adds. The question is how to address it.
The HDIP allows for a lot of really flexible and innovative ways to get more inventory of affordable housing.
According to Oregon Housing and Community Services, things may be looking up. A slowing population growth rate coupled with a strong residential construction sector will help address the affordable housing shortage. But the state needs to build 500,000 housing units over the next two decades to meet the need. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The newly appointed Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, is connected to a church based in Moscow, Idaho, that has extreme views on Christianity, including the belief that the United States should follow biblical law. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ties with a controversial church based in Idaho, and critics say the church's Christian nationalist views could guide his role in the Trump administration. Hegseth is part of a church in Tennessee associated with the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, founded by Doug Wilson in Moscow, Idaho in the 1970s. The church holds extreme beliefs, including that the United States should follow biblical law. Julie Ingersoll is a religious studies professor at the University of North Florida who has studied Christian Reconstructionists like Wilson. She says Hegseth's church is not like a megachurch in which you walk in and think of yourself as a member.
That's just not how this kind of a church system works. In order to join, you have to attest to believing the same things. And in order to remain a member, you have to continue to believe those things.
Ingersoll says membership is strict, and if people's beliefs change, they can be brought before the church courts on heresy charges. Wilson began his movement in part because he found a lack of sufficient Christian school options for his daughter. The Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches has congregations in almost all 50 states and holds other extreme views, such as criminalization of people in the LGBTQ community. They're also deeply patriarchal, which Ingersoll says is a label the church itself uses, with some arguing that women shouldn't have the right to vote. Ingersoll notes that Hegseth backtracked during his confirmation hearing on whether women should serve in the military.
He kind of switched it in a soft way to not believing that women should be in combat. And that gives a flexibility to allow people to hear what he's saying and go, oh yeah, maybe that's not a terrible thing.
In 2020, Hegseth published a book that mischaracterized the Islamic faith and positioned Muslims as historic enemies of the West. Ingersoll says this belief also flows from the church of which he belongs.
For him, Islam and all other world religions and all other ideological systems, all isms, flow out of original sin in the Garden of Eden, because they're all based in this idea that humans can reason apart from God.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Groundwater is getting saltier, so researchers are looking at crops like Sally cornea that can thrive in salty conditions. Suzanne Potter explains.
As climate change warms the planet, salty water and soil are making it harder to grow crops in California and around the world. Evaporation leaves salt in the topsoil. Rising sea levels are tainting coastal aquifers, and fresh water stored underground for irrigation is being depleted. So researchers are looking into edible plants that thrive on salty water. Vanessa Molino, a research scientist and lecturer at the University of Newcastle in Australia, says salicornia, or sea asparagus, is a good candidate.
It's salty, fresh, and crunchy, like sea asparagus or sea beans. And this oil from the seeds is really rich in fats and protein.
Countries that currently import cooking oil could grow salicornia, which is popular in Mexico and Europe and used in salads, stir-fries, and pickles. Nonprofits are working to get viable seeds to low-income farmers in places like Vietnam and eastern Ghana, where the water has become too salty for traditional crops. NASA predicts that by the year 2100, more than 70% of U.S. coastal aquifers may be salinized. Molino says farmers and governments in California are concerned.
There's quite extensive engineering practices that are established underneath the crops to remove salt. But we have to start thinking of this in many different ways.
High salinity in the Colorado River costs an estimated $348 million per year in lower crop yields and damage to infrastructure. Advocates want to see more funding for programs to breed climate-resistant crops and to develop the market to sell them. This story is based on original reporting by Ashley Stimson for Nexus News Media and Sentient, and is part of a collaborative reporting project exploring a just and climate-friendly food system. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Trump faces backlash for restricting press access. The defense secretary's ties to a controversial church spark debate, and Speaker Mike Johnson struggles with votes for a budget that include health care cuts. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The White House press team in this administration will determine who gets to enjoy the very privileged and limited access in spaces such as Air Force One and the Oval Office.
White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt says the administration will decide which media outlets get access, not the White House Correspondents Association, which has done so for a century. The Associated Press has already been barred for refusing to rename the Gulf of Mexico. A federal judge is reviewing the legality of the ban, which free speech advocates are decrying. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's ties to a Tennessee church with Christian nationalist ties is sparking alarm. Some congregations in the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches advocate what they call biblical law, including denying women the vote. Hegseth has previously opposed women in the military, although he has moved away from that stance. After briefly delaying a vote, the House has passed a budget resolution. Dissent from moderate Republicans over cuts to health care and from hardliners seeking more deficit reduction did not stop the spending outline. Alaska healthcare workers are warning against a plan to take $800 billion out of Medicaid to pay for extending tax cuts that mostly go to corporations and high-income households. Shannon Davenport with the Alaska Nurses Association says the program covers more than a third of the people in that rural state.
So we would have people going without health care, children going without preventative health care, from vaccine to checkups. Something as basic as I start out with a cold, but now I've got pneumonia and I have to be admitted to a hospital, which could have been avoided.
Meanwhile, more than 20 civil service employees have resigned from DOGE, citing concerns over dismantling public services. In a joint letter, they wrote, "We swore to serve the American people and uphold our oath to the Constitution. We can no longer honor those commitments." A new poll finds Western voters largely oppose cutting federal land and wildlife agencies. Dave Metz with FM3 Research says there's bipartisan support for national parks and conservation services.
The answers are overwhelming. They would oppose such cuts. Three quarters of Western voters overall express opposition, and that sentiment is thoroughly bipartisan.
That survey came before the Trump administration fired thousands of National Park and Forest Service workers. Arkansas is expanding free breakfast to include all students, even those at charter and private schools. The new Food Insecurity Fund will cover the cost through general funds, grants, and medical marijuana taxes. Sylvia Blaine of the Arkansas Hunger Relief Alliance says one in four children there faces hunger.
We know that there's a lot of kids out there that are not being fed three meals a day at home. To know that they can come to school and get breakfast, it's hard to have anyone argue against that.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article detailing the cozy relationship between a city administrator and the Portland Metro Chamber. At 6, it's The Underground, produced by the KBOO Youth Collective. This episode is all about their special interests. Then at 7, PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with an overnight low of 36. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 63. Today in history, in 2012, 17-year-old African-American student Trayvon Martin is shot to death by neighborhood watch coordinator George Zimmerman in Florida. The quote of the day is from French poet Victor Hugo, born this day in 1802. He wrote Les Mis, quote, "Would you realize what revolution is? Call it progress. And would you realize what progress is? Call it tomorrow."
A South Dakota bill to place curriculum on Native tribes in every school was defeated in the state Senate. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A legislative push to place the Ocheti Chacoin Essential Understandings, or OSEUs, in every South Dakota school has died on the Senate floor. Lawmakers say now is time to change course. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
In what represented a relatively strong push to mandate the program in the state, the proposal was ultimately trounced on the Senate floor on a vote of 7-28. Many of the no's were from lawmakers concerned with potential changes to education and the qualifications of educators to teach these lessons. Lower Brule Republican Senator Tamara Grove said it was a challenge to sit through the vote.
Just being really vulnerable, it was very personal, and you're not supposed to get attached to your bills like that, but I did, and so it was a hard loss, but I'm okay. That kind of compels, you know, like it just compels you forward, and so that is why I'm not quitting.
Grove says she believes in the OSEUs and their power to improve state-tribal relations.
My mind was on like the exchange students kind of theory of if you know people from across the waters, right, you're less likely to go to war with them. A big part of the divide in the state of South Dakota is because we don't understand each other. We don't know each other.
That sentiment was echoed by Oglala Lakota Democratic Senator Red Dawn Foster.
If you talk to college students till this day, they will say that they weren't aware that there were 9 tribes within the state's boundaries of South Dakota, and how the state boundaries became a fact, and that the fact that the reservations and tribal nations supersede the state as well as the, you know, federal government. So how can you know your neighbors if you don't know the history?
Grove says she's now working on a non-legislative push via the Department of Education to further incorporate the OSEUs into schooling. I'm SDPB's CJ Keene in Pierre.
Native Americans needing help with addiction and substance abuse have an option opening this month in the town of Sheridan, Oregon. KLCC's Brian Bull reports on the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde's new residential treatment facility.
Turned out just amazing. We did a blessing ceremony on Friday.
With dark wood decor and soothing tones of gray and green, the Main Street Recovery Facility is spacious and calming. Operations Director Jennifer Worth shows where clients will sleep, meet, do chores, and get wraparound services.
Having full access to counseling, group, case management, any other hands-on services that a tribal member may need.
Worth says any Native American 18 or older can be helped here if they are medically stable and beds are available.
Other things we're working on, hopefully adding a sweat lodge in the back.
Kelly Rao is the executive director of Tribal Health Services for the Grand Ronde. She says like their opioid recovery clinics in Salem and Portland, the Sheridan facility integrates Western medicine with Native practices.
Culture is medicine for us, making sure that we don't lose sight of who we are as a people and how we want our tribal members, as well as other Natives, to feel that they're part of something bigger and that we're here for them.
The recovery center will be taking a few clients next week. Up to 18 beds are on site in an area adjacent to the Grand Ronde Reservation, part of a major $6 billion opioid settlement to help fund the Main Street Recovery Facility. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Martin Heinrich have reintroduced legislation for essential veterinary services in tribal communities. The bill authorizes the Indian Health Service to provide services to domestic animals. The legislation aims to address the overpopulation of stray and abandoned dogs in Indian country, which the senators say is a significant public health and safety issue. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Scientists are trying to figure out how to help the ocean absorb even more climate-changing pollution. They want to accelerate a natural process that locks down carbon dioxide for thousands of years. Dr. Anthony Lizoweth has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizoweth, and this is Climate Connections. The ocean absorbs almost a third of the world's climate-warming carbon pollution, so it plays a critical role in limiting global warming. And scientists are researching ways to help the ocean absorb and store even more CO2. Alicia Karspek is with Seaworthy, a nonprofit research group that's investigating a method called ocean alkalinity enhancement. The approach involves adding certain crushed minerals, like lime or silicate, to the ocean. That increases the water's alkalinity, triggering a chemical process that converts dissolved carbon dioxide into a molecule called bicarbonate. The carbon then stays locked in this form for thousands of years.
It's actually a natural process that happens already on very long geologic timescales, and it's a matter of just accelerating that natural process.
Doing so reduces the amount of dissolved CO2 at the ocean surface,
which then allows the ocean to actually take up more carbon from the atmosphere.
Her group is partnering on research to study the approach and monitor its impact on marine ecosystems and ocean chemistry. There are many questions to answer before it can be deployed on a large scale, but it could one day provide a way to help reduce climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
From federal workers to nonprofits and farmers, Americans are being hit hard by the Trump administration's government efficiency initiative to reduce what it terms, quote, fraud and waste. One Wisconsin organization, despite being personally affected by these cuts, is working to provide resources to as many folks as possible while making sure their voices are heard by the state lawmakers. Judith Ruiz Branch has more in Madison.
Communities in Wisconsin are feeling the widespread effects of federal cuts, and some organizations are pitching in to help those who've experienced funding freezes and mass layoffs. Rural areas depend heavily on federal funds for vital services like healthcare, education, and infrastructure, and farmers who were counting on federal grant reimbursements are reeling from payment delays, waiting in some cases for up to $70,000. Nonprofits like the Wisconsin Farmers Union, headed by Julie Bomar, are seeing some of their grant funding slashed for diversity-related programs.
Something changes about every day with this, and it's a really crazy, chaotic time, both for nonprofits like ours, but also for the farmers that we work with. And so the uncertainty is really critical right now.
She says the Farmers Union held a town meeting last week so elected officials could hear firsthand from community members about what they're experiencing. The Trump administration says the federal cuts are an effort to optimize efficiency and clean up what it calls fraud and waste. There are about 18,000 federal employees in Wisconsin. The DOGE website shows federal offices in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, and Merrill are set to be terminated or consolidated. Bomar says some Wisconsin workers at agencies like the National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service, the National Conservation Resource Service, Farm Service Agency, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture have already lost their jobs. She says it's all taking a critical toll and cites a report of a former NRCS employee who took their own life after being fired.
So trying to then connect people with farmer mental health resources so that they can also be talking to people and finding the support that they need to get through this chaos.
This comes as the country is already grappling with a mental health crisis with limited resources. Bomar says she gets calls and messages daily from people sharing how they and their families are being affected. She adds the Wisconsin Farmers Union will keep looking for ways to help them. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael just realized America's a business, not a country.
Since the U.S. is the world's number one arms merchant, it's only honest that Ukraine pay the U.S. for what we thought was aid to a friend against a common enemy, an enemy that now has more influence in Washington than most of us citizens put together. America is selling not only weaponry, but protection. Protection from others, and also protection from the U.S. taking your country or canal. Trump is selling access not only to corporations, but also the press. If you want to be on the press plane, you have to echo and compliment the pilot. Soon anyone can be a U.S. citizen for $5 million. Probably Trump will change our country's spelling, replacing the S in USA with a dollar sign. Congress passed a budget proposing what they will spend without having to say what they'll cut. And despite tens of thousands of fewer employees, they'll need cuts in Medicare and Medicaid to continue tax cuts for the wealthy. Life is a bitch in America. If you're not rich in America, tell your tired, your poor, your huddled masses to go yearn somewhere else. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 26, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Judith Ruiz Branch, Suzanne Potter, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Nate Kapp. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest article. It's called Drinking in the Dark: Cozy Relationship Between City Administrator and Business Lobbyist Highlights Potential Conflicts of Interest Around Zenith Energy, Other Executive Functions. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. This new article of yours tackles the relationship between Deputy City Administrator Donnie Oliveira and Portland Metro Chamber Executive Vice President John Isaacs and their meeting ahead of the city's controversial Zenith decision recently. This is starting out from public records that you got. So what were you able to find?
Right, just a little bit of backstory. Street Roots has been filing for a lot of just kind of a wide variety of public records around the Zenith Energy thing and the kind of main players that are involved since early December. And, you know, one of the things with public records, they come back, you find one thing, you find another thing that leads to more requests and more records. So we have some, you know, thousands of pages around how this kind of thing has gone down, largely because environmental advocates feared that the city would try to rush through this land use statement for Zenith before the new form of government began in early January. So there's a lot of tension here, I think, around what powers the city council has versus what powers the executive branch, the mayor, and these city administrators have, that has really come to light, I think, around this Zenith thing, although it's not always directly only related to